KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and thank you for listening today. Today I'm really excited to have on Professor Alistair Roberts, author of the book Blacked Out, Government Secrecy in the Information Age. This is an issue which, for those of you who have been listening to my show regularly, is an area of particular interest for me, as someone that has focused on trade secrecy and intellectual property. The larger issue of government transparency and accountability is something that's always fascinated me, and I'm always looking for good books that focus on this issue. And in Professor Roberts' book, I think I've found it. The book is off Cambridge University Press, and it came out earlier this year. It has received numerous accolades at this point. Among them, Professor Roberts has informed me that it is has won the 2006 Lewis Brownlow Award given by the National Academy of Public Administration for an outstanding contribution to literature in the field. Professor Roberts' book is exhaustive in its scope, covering not just United States freedom of information issues and secrecy issues, but really examining the globe, different countries' experiences with these issues and what it means, and also looking at the different issues that impact secrecy itself and how the secrecy world operates. In other words, how governments themselves make these decisions, what factors go into the ability for the public to access information, covering everything from corporate secrecy to technology to government change. It's really an incredibly well-researched and readable book, and so I'm very excited to have Professor Roberts on today. By way of very brief background before I put him on the air, Professor Roberts is an associate professor of public administration in the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University, not too far from where I went to school at Cornell. He's also the director of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse and an honorary senior research fellow of the Constitution Unit, University College London. Like so many of my guests, Professor Roberts is also an attorney. He has a JD from the University of Toronto and a PhD in public policy from Harvard. And his research focuses in this area and in other areas, but I'm really, really looking forward to having an in-depth discussion of some of the nuances of Professor Roberts' book, Blacked Out, Government Secrecy in the Information Age. Love is a very strong word, and I don't want to go so far as to say that I love Professor Roberts, but I am very happy that he's on the show today. So, Alistair, I hope you're there.
Yes.
Terrific. Again, I don't want you to feel too uncomfortable with the choice of that song initially, but let's dive right in. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
My pleasure.
Let's start off really with the opening question, really amounting to the whys. How did you get into this issue, and why did you write this book, and how is it timely today?
Well, I started off doing research on government reform in Canada, where I worked for several years, and I was using the Canadian version of the Freedom of Information Law for quite some time. I got pretty good at it. And then in the late 1990s, a journalist group up in Canada asked if I would do a survey of how well all of the Canadian FOI laws, the federal and all the provincial laws, were working. I said, sure, I'd do that. And as it happens, it was just good timing, because in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, there was just this explosion of interest in freedom of information law around the world. Between about 1995 and about 2006, there are maybe 50 countries that have adopted laws like the U.S. Freedom of Information Act. So it's just been a boom time, an extraordinary time, and that's really how I got into it.
The book itself, as I mentioned in the introduction, covers not just U.S. freedom of information and U.S. secrecy issues, but it appears that you traveled the globe doing this research. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I did have the opportunity to go to some very interesting places. I went to India and watched a social action group in a small Rajasthani village using their new Right to Information Act. I went to Germany and saw the former archives of the German secret police, which was a fascinating thing to go through. I've had the opportunity to go to Latin America. It's just one of the consequences of this really intriguing international movement.
The movement itself, kind of to set the stage, the Freedom of Information Act, the U.S. version, passed in the mid-60s, really did open the door to considering these issues of transparency that go back to, you know, Jeremy Bentham and others. I'm curious, before we get into some of the details of the book, if in your world travels you found that the people that you were talking to in these different countries were familiar with the U.S. history in this area, or were they operating really independently of those kinds of influences?
Well, the transparency is a really flexible word, which is one of the reasons why it's so popular these days. And there are some groups, say national groups, groups interested in human rights or social action, community mobilization, that are using it as a technique essentially to get government to open up and be more responsive. And many of those groups are looking at the American law or the Swedish law, which was a very old law as well, or some of the Commonwealth laws, which are sort of a second generation from the U.S. So they're looking to the West. There's also group of organizations like the World Trade Organization, the IMF, which has been pushing transparency as well. They have a different agenda, and they have a different understanding of what transparency is about. But one of the reasons the word has such power these days is that you've got all of these different groups using the same language,
mm-hmm.
if for different reasons.
It's a good idea for listeners of the show. As you may know, the Hearsay Culture audience is fairly diverse, running from experts, attorneys, and people in technology field to people that are learning about these issues and just want to broaden their horizons. But you raise an interesting question, which kind of gets us into some of the details of your book, which is this euphemistic, somewhat vague word, transparency. How do you define it, or how do you use it generally in your book?
Generally in the book, I'm talking about the obligation of government agencies or bodies that are doing governmental work, public work, the obligation to release information, and they may do it, as they say, some kind of inelegantly, proactively, you know, on their own initiative, or they may be compelled to do it because somebody has asked for it. But it's basically about getting information or documents in the possession of a government agency out into the public domain.
And when you talk about the public domain, you're not talking about third-party watchdog-type organizations or escrow groups. You're speaking literally of the public having the ability to access this information.
Well, you know, that's one of the issues. Generally, when I'm talking about into the public domain, I mean released to a non-governmental actor without any access restrictions on it. So, And very often when you hear the rhetoric of transparency, it will be pitched as, you know, citizens looking for information on their own account. It is true that in different places you find citizens looking for information they need because it's something about a benefit or a penalty that's been levied on them specifically. But very often these laws work because it's some non-governmental group, a stakeholder group, a watchdog group, that is using the law. The truth is that sometimes these things are difficult to use, and you need to have resources and expertise to do it well.
Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is one of the challenges, certainly in the U.S., when it comes to Freedom of Information or FOIA litigation, is really figuring out where the documents are in the particular government agency or entity that from whom you're making the request. Let's turn to the basic outline of your book, and as I mentioned in the introduction, I think it does a great job of laying out some of the wrinkles that color how transparency, and I'll use it in the same general term that you've defined it today, impact these governmental operations. So one of the topics that you discuss is the issue of privatization. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about that. It's as I mentioned in the introduction, it's an area of personal interest to me. But you talk heavily in the book about how public-private partnerships, the known as PPPs in many circles, are impacting transparency and access information because it is, in fact, private entities that are taking on governmental roles. Can you discuss that a little bit in the context of how it's impacting the public's ability to get information?
Well, this is one of the big issues. I basically say in the book that freedom of information as we know it is one of the, in the United States, is one of the legacies of the system of regulating bureaucratic power that was built up after the 1930s. We had this extension of bureaucratic power in the U.S., and then we had a lot of people concerned about the potential abuse of that power, and we saw the buildup of sort of a regulatory structure for channeling the exercise of bureaucratic power. And freedom of information is one of those things. And the irony is that just as we sort of get the finishing touches done on that regulatory structure, power is shifting out to contractors or non-governmental organizations that are doing public work. And the predicament is that usually right to information laws or freedom of information laws just don't cover contractors or quasi-governmental organizations.
The battle that I've taken a look at is the issue of trade secrecy, in particular the idea of this commercial doctrine would be used by companies ranging from Diebold voting machines to others when they're in fact involved in government contracting. And in your section where you talk about some of this stuff, you mention in your chapter entitled Soft States this law in South Africa, which is really quite remarkable. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about that and how you see that law impacting what's happening, at least in that country.
You mind if I just back up, though, and tell you a bit more about the predicament here?
Because please.
It's partly a question of can you hold contractors accountable? For example, when you look at Iraq and you do a straight headcount of allied forces in Iraq, the second largest component of the allied forces in Iraq is not the British, as many people would think. It's actually contractors working for Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing everything from something that looks pretty close to combat to policing and security, interrogation, backup functions, and so on. And those contractors generally are not subject to the same transparency requirements as the government workers they're working alongside. So contractors are one predicament. The other predicament is what are sometimes known as quasi-governmental organizations. So ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, is a great example as well because it's set up as a nonprofit organization under Californian law, if I'm not mistaken. Now, it has governance functions for the Internet, but it's not subject to any right to information law either. The Congress just set up another, or rather gave regulatory authority to another entity called the North American Electricity Reliability Council, which is going to essentially regulate security and reliability standards for the power industry in the United States. And it's not subject to right to information. So you got all these organizations doing critical public functions not covered. Now, the way the South Africans have tried to fix that is to bring in a law that says we don't care whether this organization is public or private, governmental or not. Any organization is basically subject to the idea of right to information. You as a citizen can ask any organization for information that's essential to protect any of your other fundamental rights.
Which is to me, and to any reading, is a very broad reading of not only of privacy or elimination of it, but also of the idea of what individuals have a right to handle. What's been the have you had the opportunity to see how that law? First of all, is that law in fact being utilized in South Africa, and what its impact has been?
Well, the critical thing in any country with any law is basically not just what it says, but what it means in practice, because implementation is usually a huge issue, especially when you've got a law as broad as this one in South Africa. They've had difficulties with compliance in South Africa and in particular difficulties in figuring out what it means when you start applying this law to the private sector. The government actually tried to back away from the initial intention of the law, but it's being slowly tested through court challenges right now.
The ability of individuals to access information which may impact their rights. And the depth of the potential application of a law like that kind of leads me to an overarching question, which can set the stage for digging into some of other areas, which if you were to identify a general thesis of your book, well, how would you define it?
Well, I think there are two points. The first is that one of the main points of the book is to be wary about undue optimism about the extent to which we're achieving transparency. When you get through the rhetoric, there are these huge challenges, like the challenge posed by privatization, that we're going to have to grapple with. But I think the other point, too, very often the sort of classical liberal way of thinking about transparency, and this is very often true in the United States, is to say that it's a tool for checking governmental power. It's a way we keep government under control. And I think we need to refine that and say, no, this is a way of checking centers of power, entities that are capable of influencing our lives or shape or hurting or advancing our fundamental interests. And when you put it that way, that organization might be public, it might be private, it might be national, it might be supranational. The material question is, how much power does it have and how does it wield that power? And will some kind of transparency rule help us to hold that power to account?
You talk about in the beginning of the book, which I think moves us in that direction to define some of those parameters. You talk about the, and I'm not a Latin scholar, but you talk about the arcani imperii.
Yeah.
Am I pronouncing that roughly correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's my English teachers in middle school would be thrilled. To the data smog. How is that, first of all, defining what you mean by those two terms? How does that define and kind of lay out the world that we're discussing today?
Well, it's basically talking about an era about two centuries ago in which the hard premise was that the public had no right to information held by government. These were secrets that had to be closely held by government leaders, the royal court in that time, because only the court had the big picture or the expertise to understand what to do with the information. And we have been slowly, over time, trying to battle that presumption of secrecy. And data smog is essentially an argument made by some individuals, and I don't subscribe to this camp, that we've now gone fairly close to the other extreme, which is that we have so much information that the problem is not accessing information, it's digesting, interpreting the information that's publicly available. And I place myself well short of that extreme. I think we're still, the question of interpreting the information is out there, but in many areas it's still a basic battle over getting the secrets of the court, as it were.
And that raises an interesting point, which I want to dig into a little bit. The wealth of information that exists out there, and I'm speaking not only of the internet, but also just of general knowledge that people ascertain living in a world where they have access to information and therefore can draw their own conclusions about what's happening around them that are perhaps, arguably, more well-informed than they might have been in the past, also raises the issue of, and it's a question I often get when I talk about these issues, which is, why do people need this information in the first place? In other words, there's so much out there just by Googling anything on the internet that to suggest that there isn't enough information about certain aspects of our life really challenges the individual to decide how much time do they really have in their life to devote to finding out every particular crevice and every particular concern that may exist in a given area that they deem to be important. How do you respond, or what are your thoughts on the idea that there's plenty of information out there already and that ultimately the public doesn't need to know all these things?
Well, you know, this is not an issue I raise in the book, but it's an interesting point. I'm an academic researcher. I spend a lot of time on the internet. I use Google regularly, and the thought occurred to me the other day that I trust Google as a search engine, And as a researcher, I think that when I'm using Google, and Google's not the only thing I use, but I think when I'm using Google that I'm doing a sort of comprehensive search of available material. But then I know nothing about the way Google works. I know nothing about its algorithms. I know nothing about what it is capable of retrieving, and I know nothing about the big black hole that is never penetrated by Google. I put complete trust in this tool, which is a fairly uncomfortable position for a researcher to be in. But, you know, there are some areas that even Google can't penetrate. If you've got private multinationals running key public services, Google doesn't get you access to the internal information about how they run their operations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got a multinational, and there are now multinationals that are running prisons or detention centers in many different countries, Google can't get me the internal information about the way they treat their prisoners or the manner in which they enforce security within their operations. There are still large areas that are not yet penetrated by that sort of ethos of total transparency.
There are countries like Australia that have you know, deep histories with public-private partnerships, and companies like Macquarie that operates private roads and other entities really kind of begs the question. When I was doing my own research on these issues, I was a bit surprised in my initial foray to find out how much has been thought through in other countries that doesn't seem to have been thought through here. I'm curious, in your survey of the world, as it were, I recognize, of course, that we're not literally speaking of every country on the planet, but based upon your own research, what countries are leading the way, as you see it, in opening up and making less opaque their government?
Well, historically, it is countries like the United States, Sweden, a couple of the older, if we're looking at freedom of information, access to basic governmental information,
mm-hmm.
and some of the advanced democracies, in particular the Anglo-American and Nordic democracies, that have been leading the way. But then, you know, when we start to talk about public-private partnerships, we're back to square one.
It's literally that far removed from where we are in government access.
Well, you know, right now the one of the hot button issues is, can you get a copy of the contract? That's sort of the first question that comes up when a government goes into business with a private actor to run some major piece of infrastructure or run a school or run a prison. Is the contract going to be publicly accessible? But that's really only the outer shell of the issue. What about all of those internal documents within the institution that pertain to the operation of the institution? Is there going to be a right to information of that sort, the internal documents that shape the way the institution treats people?
Has the South African model, to use that phrase, been picked up by other countries? Is that something which has received much support outside of South Africa and the unique circumstances under which that law was created, which you discuss in your book?
I think the South African law is basically a product of unusual circumstances, maybe a historical accident, and it's really tough to imagine any other country adopting a law that says there is a right to information held by anybody, public or private, in the same terms as the South African law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you imagine just proposing that sort of legislation in the United States, you can just imagine what the industry lobbies would start to say.
Yeah, I think there are certainly plenty of countervailing reasons why you would not want to go quite that far if you believe in the basic concept of private property, which I think is where often this debate centers, is the idea of privacy and why shouldn't I have the right to keep private that which I choose to keep private.
That's right. And it is also true that, you know, in countries like the United States, there already is a hodgepodge of statutes that allow access to certain kinds of information held by private actors and, you know, obligations on the part of even private universities or other private institutions to disclose information. So to some degree, the South Africans were where they were because they didn't have that existing array of legislative requirements.
When we're going to go into a short music break now, and when I return, I want to touch a little bit on two big issues in your book. The first is technology. This show being Hearsay Culture, focusing on technology. I would like to discuss that, and I also want to talk about the criticism and the critique that you offer of the access to information not matching, if you will, the citizens or the public's reaction to getting the information, and where that leads us. It's an interesting point, which gets to your original point about how far we've really gone and where we need to go.
Before we return with Alistair Roberts, author of the book Blacked Out, Government Secrecy in the Information Age, I want to ask you, as I always do at the bottom of the hour, whether you are enjoying listening to KZSU, and particularly whether you're enjoying listening to Hearsay Culture. And you can always email me at dlevine@law.stanford.edu and let me know. But assuming that you are, or assuming that you're listening to KZSU and deciding, I wonder how KZSU operates and how they stay on the air, I'm going to ask you to donate to KZSU and help KZSU continue bringing the dynamic programming that it does, not only in the Bay Area, but streaming on the Internet at kzsu.stanford.edu. So if you're interested, please email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And please keep on listening. So, Alistair, we're back. And let's turn to the issue of technology. Technology, again, being the focus of this show. I'm curious, you talk in your book about the difference between structured and unstructured data. Why don't you talk a little bit about what those two terms mean and how they impact your analysis?
Well, the distinction basically is between standardized databases, large databases that hold well-defined kinds of information, and unstructured information is essentially everything else. The mass of what we would think of in paper terms as, memoranda, briefing notes, research papers, PowerPoint presentations, and so on. So that's the distinction. We've had, over the last 20 years, a buildup, well, more than 20 years, 30 or 40 years, a buildup of large databases, and then a debate about how we think about transparency or access to information held in these large standardized databases. And then more recently, the question is, how do you think about transparency as that vast pool of what used to be stuff in filing cabinets gets transformed into digitized form, whether it's, as I say, memoranda, PowerPoints, and so on?
The use of this technology by governments is something that has always been a bit of a challenge, and generally when you look at issues involving discovery and litigation and things like that, you often have situations where people write things in emails and say things in a permanent form by way of writing that they would never say publicly. And I'm curious to know, in as far as technology goes, how much of what you call the paperless office is really something that the government is involved in? In other words, is the government building, in your estimation, these same enormous paper trails that we see in the private sector?
Yes, and the one of the main points I try to make in the book is that there's this sort of dance between technology, law, and transparency requirements, and it's not yet clear how it's all going to work out, but there are people who say one of the difficulties with transparency laws is that people don't write anything down anymore. And one of the counters to that is, yes, but you've got the advent of new technologies such as email, which means that things that were never recorded before, essentially conversations, are now in digitized form and easily accessible. And I think government officials, after a while, sharpen up to what they should or should not say to emails. But it is true that there's a repository of information there, potentially subject to access, that was not there 20 years ago.
I want to read you, I want to quote you. On page 213 of your book, you say, technology plays an unappreciated role in exaggerating our perceptions of government secretiveness.
That seems like a counterintuitive point. I'd like to probe that. What do you mean by that sentence? How is that developed in your book?
Well, I think in when I was saying that, I was referring to there's every year a little report that comes out from the federal government that purports to show how much information has been classified in the preceding year. And the number, you know, ticks up now and then, and there's alarm about the growth of government secrecy. And I think the point I was trying to make there was, well, yeah, but what we probably need to remember is that the total stock of government information in the previous year probably grew quite substantially as well,
mm-hmm.
precisely because of the impact of new technologies. And so I don't want to diminish concerns about the adequacy of the classification system, but the critical question is what proportion of the total stock of government information is being subject to classification rules? Because you can expect that, you know, if you had a comparable count just of, let's say, the number of records or the amount of information in bytes held by government, that it would be growing exponentially over the last couple decades as well.
The ability of governments to keep this information itself is another challenge from the technology perspective. And I want to see if you have any thoughts on it. There's always a question when you're trying to get this information and trying to maintain records generally when you're in business. The question comes up, how much are we going to hold on to and how long are we going to hold on to it? And there are always good practices and best practices in terms of how many years you keep a file and that kind of thing. But again, government being having always dealing with budget constraints, what's your sense of how much information is there that goes back beyond a couple of years? In other words, in terms of maintaining a government that isn't completely open, do you find or do you have a sense that governments are, in light of the technology, retaining more information and therefore there's more potentially to get a hold of?
In theory, yeah, there is more being generated that might be subject to transparency. But, you know, the critical question is how good a job is the government doing in keeping relevant information and keeping it in such a way that it's easily accessed. You know, we make a big assumption. We're all for right to information laws, but we make a big assumption that the government agency that we're imposing the law on is capable itself of finding and retrieving the information that we'd like to have. And there are two versions of that argument. The one is the sort of rich country version, and that's the problem of countries that have gone through the revolution, the technological revolution, and are trying to figure out what of this mass of digitized information they need to keep. And then there are developing countries that are a few years behind that are still dealing with the question of how do you maintain proper records in any form, whether it's paper records in manila folders, so that they can be retrieved when a citizen's looking for them.
We're of course, limited in time, so I can't go into the level of detail that I'd like on all of these issues, but I'm curious, if you were to give a nutshell best practice for retention policies for government, how would you define it? If you can do that, and if you can do that in 30 seconds, I'll be very impressed.
I'd have a pretty good consulting business. I don't have a neat answer to that. I mean, clearly, governments need to be able to show what decisions they've made, what reasons they had for making decisions. On critical decisions, you want to see some of the paper trail on deliberations, but it's a difficult issue.
I have a tendency, it's always the challenge of doing this radio show where we have about less than an hour really to have these discussions to figure out how deep can I go in a topic without making it something where someone has to pull out a chart or use a visual or a PowerPoint. And perhaps I stepped over the line with a government best practice. So,
but there's an interesting point here.
Uh-huh.
Very often we think that, government is keeping secrets from us. Government is not telling us some critical piece of information. And very often the problem is that government can't find the information itself,
mm-hmm.
That it has its own access to information problem. It can't sort organize, retrieve the massive information that's held right across government agencies. And so we don't want to overstate the capability of government in terms of organizing themselves, essentially.
The it relates to, although it's not identical, to the point that you talk about transparency within a network of entities or individuals, and transparency outside that network. What's the core difference there between those two issues?
Well, the key point I was trying to make there is that we've always had this problem of secrecy in the security sector, by which I mean the collection in any particular country of law enforcement agencies, intelligence agencies, defense agencies, and so on, because secrecy is very deeply rooted in that particular part of government. More recently, and especially since the end of the Cold War, you've seen those organizations reaching across national borders and striking deals, essentially, that say that let's share information in the interest of collective security, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But very often the rules of the game are that any shared information can never be released to any other party, whether it's a legislator, maybe a political overseer, a citizen, and so on. So over time you get these networks built up, and they're built on the premise of transparency within the network. All the agencies get to share information, and they're better off. But the rules of the game are constructed in such a way that people outside the network find it hard to know what's going on inside.
The security issues there are obviously paramount, especially today and certainly in the United States and in the culture that we have now, where we have a increased, it seems, fear of information being disseminated. And I'm curious to get your kind of broad general thoughts on the whole debate involving security through transparency. The idea being that the more information that's out there, the more secure we ultimately will be. Well, do you have any thoughts on that general idea?
Well, I think you have to have faith in the capacity of an open society to reach the right decision through informed deliberation. And let me give you an illustration. If we had had a more open discussion in 2002 and 2003 about the threat posed by Iraq, or the estimates of their capabilities in weapons of mass destruction, or about plans for going into Iraq and post-war reconstruction, if we'd had that conversation more transparently, I think the security position of the United States would be better today than it is at the moment.
And again, by having the discussion more transparently, what deficiencies do you see in the discussions as they occurred then?
Well, we had a lack of candor about the actual threat posed by Iraq, an overstatement of the threat posed and its capabilities and weapons of mass destruction, and we had essentially a refusal to talk about what the requirements would be to go into Iraq and reconstruct the country after the invasion, essentially a refusal to talk openly about what the requirements would be and what post-war planning would look like.
Do you find in those kinds of discussions, when we're dealing with issues of national security or foreign policy, you often get the, at least, again, I say you, I mean, my own experience, is when you suggest that there should be more transparency, a reaction often boils down to, well, there's critical infrastructure, there are things that we just don't need to know about. And certainly there are laws in the United States dealing with exempting critical infrastructure information from FOIA and from general open government rules. I'm curious whether you think those laws, or I'll put it another way, do you think those laws are addressing the ultimate concern that the legislation is supposed to deal with, which is the idea that there is just some information which we don't want to be made public? Or do you think it's being used as the proverbial, hole that you could drive a truck through to protect information that really shouldn't be secret? Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, first of all, we want to concede that there's some information about vulnerabilities that should not go out in the public domain. And it's also true that immediately after an attack, you're probably, and probably rightly, going to be concerned conservative in making decisions about disclosure. But in the longer run, you have to strike a balance, and you have to recognize that sometimes transparency is essential in order to get complex systems to reform, and that if you don't have a certain level of transparency, some way of getting some kind of information out about how corporations or government agencies are doing, that they're likely in the long run to underperform. They're going to not meet the challenge of tightening security. So let me give you an illustration. It's common practice to do tests of security at different kinds of airports. And immediately after 9/11, governments, the U.S. and Canadian government, said, okay, we're not going to release information about the results of those tests at specific airports because it's essentially telling the terrorists where to get on a plane. And the response to that would be fair enough. But let's find some way of washing the data so that it can be released, let's say, aggregated for all national airports, or anonymize the data, or find some way of getting some information out so that we can hold governments and airports accountable for tightening security. Because we know the way bureaucracies work. If they are not subject to external pressure, there are too many incentives for them to avoid hard reforms.
It kind of leads into the remaining time that we have left, kind of the crystal ball question. And whenever I ask this crystal ball question of guests, I give the caveat, first I apologize for asking the question, because as a litigator, I was always asked these questions, will we win, and what's going to happen, and you never have an exact answer. So with that caveat, where do you think we're headed on transparency in the United States right now? If you were to predict whether we'll have a more or less open society in 5 years from now, what's your sense?
Well, I think, let me pitch it a little higher and say globally that
okay.
We're going through a moment of what I might call transparency euphoria, and that's going to wear off in a couple of years. And people will begin to appreciate that there are actually different agendas here, sometimes conflicting agendas, that sometimes implementing these laws that we've adopted is really tough, that bureaucracies and politicians are much more obdurate than we might have imagined, and that some of these other challenges, how do you open up the private sector, or how far should you go, how do you open up international organizations, how do you open up these security networks, those are going to be really tough questions, and mobilizing coalitions to get reform is also going to be tough. So I think the bloom will be off the rose a bit in a few years, and then we're going to have a lot of scattered battles over transparency that will go on for a long time.
And it seems to tie into another point that you make in the book quite strongly, which is citizens having information but not reacting to it. I get the sense from what you've just said and from reading the book that you're very concerned that people will get information after these battles occur and the laws are improved, but ultimately won't react or even not care. Is that a major concern of yours?
Yeah, it is, and I say it in the context of the last chapter of the book was written a few months after Abu Ghraib and after the 2004 election, and you had the disclosure of fairly shocking information about abuses in Abu Ghraib. You had other issues like the practice of extraordinary rendition. At the start, we could say that there was information being withheld by these practices, but by the end of 2004, it was pretty much out in the public domain. But the difficulty is that for many people, it was just a non-issue. They either didn't tune in or they didn't act on the information they had. And so, transparency doesn't do much good if you have a citizenry that's disengaged. And so that's a challenge I think that we need to be attentive to as well. There's a tendency among transparency advocates to put it all on government and say, those guys, they're hiding things from us. If only we knew. And the predicament is that the truth is that sometimes we eventually do know. We do find out. And then the burden is on us to do something with the information we've got.
It's certainly a challenge, I think, that you've made to the public in general, and it's one that I certainly share. And I guess my last question on the topic is, ultimately, in light of that concern, which I think anyone that is immersed in any issue of more than local importance would probably say impacts their issue as well. I was involved heavily in issues involving federal budget reform and deficit reduction. And one could debate whether that's a big problem or not, but there certainly would have suggested that a lot more people would get involved in the issue than ultimately were, even at the height of the issue, when it was made most popular by Ross Perot and Paul Tsongas. And I think anyone involved in major national issues finds the same concern. At the end of the day, the last question I really have for you here is, does increased transparency solve that problem? Or are we still left with somehow trying to engage people in the world that surrounds them?
Increased transparency by itself is not a solution to the kinds of problems you've described. For example, it's a well-established fact on the public record that we're heading toward a fiscal crisis at the federal level because of the impact of a series of programs that serve an aging population. We don't need more information about the extent of that crisis. What we do need is to get citizens engaged in it and to make citizens feel that they have some way they can do something about the issue. And very often the issue is really not transparency per se. It's a question of activating citizens, showing them the path to fixing a problem.
On that note, Professor Roberts Alistair, I want to thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and discussing your work, Blacked Out: Government Secrecy in the Information Age. For people that want to learn more about this issue and about your work, where can they go?
You can go to my website, which is www.aroberts.us, and there's information about the book, reviews, and other details right there.
Alistair, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I want to thank Professor Roberts for being on today, talking about secrecy in this modern world of technology and security issues. Blacked Out: Government Secrecy in the Information Age, off Cambridge University Press. Professor Roberts' book has a great quote that I want to read because it really goes directly into the title of this show, Hearsay Culture. He says on page 218 of his book, "In the digital world, we may have more facts about the internal life of organizations, but the burden of sense-making, of deciding what all the back-and-forth means, is also increased and puts on the shoulders of individuals and organizations outside the government." With that, ultimately, is what my thinking was when I named the show Hearsay Culture, that there's a wealth of information and it's up to us to figure out what that information means. I think what Alistair's talking about in his book, and particularly what he was discussing at the end of the interview, are very prescient words, that merely getting the information out there isn't enough, that it does take people reacting to that information in order for transparency and accountability, and this is my interpretation, in order for transparency and accountability to have any meaning. I commend Professor Roberts for discussing this issue in such an in-depth way, and I look forward to following this issue generally and seeing where we're headed in the coming few years. I have a number of guests upcoming in the weeks leading up to the end of the year, including many authors of different books, everyone from Stephen Levy discussing his new book regarding iPods to Eric von Hippel at MIT discussing innovation, and Professor Henry Chesbro at Berkeley also discussing innovation, and many others, a really stellar group of guests that will be discussing very dynamic and interesting work and timely work that I would commend people to at least learn about. And by that, I mean you can listen to Hearsay Culture on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You can also find this show as a podcast, sans music, on iTunes by searching Center for Internet Society in the podcast page. And you can also, of course, find out about CIS and what the Center for Internet and Society
Society is doing by going to CIS's webpage, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I am confident that when you listen to this show, my webpage will be nearly active, and I've coming so close to having the page live, and it will be live in another couple of weeks, so look forward to that. Meanwhile, thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. Please stay tuned to the excellent musical programming on KZSU FM Stanford.